You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast. All right, this is Chris Webster, and I am back in the exhibition hall, the extremely dead exhibition hall on the last day of the Society for Historic...
Thank you, Snowmageddon.
Yeah, Snowmageddon. On the last day of the Society for Historic Archaeology Conference in St. Charles, Missouri, 2019. And I'm sitting here with Monty Dobson. Monty, how's it going?
Hello. Good. Nice to see you.
You might remember Monty from things such as... No.
from things such as the lineup at the local jail. No,
that's
never
right.
mind. No, archaeology joke.
I know. I first talked to Monty, and you might not know this. We were just geeking out on gear because Monty does video production, among many other things, for the stuff that he's doing. But the first time I recorded with you when we were talking about your first PBS series...
Yes.
I was actually working in Northern California, and we were camping at like a little camping resort, and their Wi-Fi was terrible.
Right. That's right. We Skyped in.
We Skyped in.
And it was an awful connection.
Right. Because I was sitting in my car outside a closed coffee shop that still had a Wi-Fi connection running. And I'm like, oh my God. And I remember that. I'll never forget that because I think I took a picture of that setup. I'm sitting in the passenger seat of my Prius because that's closer to the coffee shop as I'm sitting on the curb there.
To get something for Wi-Fi. Yes.
And I've got my computer in front of me. I've got my iPad up on the console to try to, get my notes right there. And then we're having this Skype conversation. Oh my God, it was so terrible. So anyway, we're in a just to call this out because I won't be able to key most of it out. But
a cavernous,
yes, a very hall. Cavernous exhibition hall. I mean, in our favor for recording, there's hardly anybody in here. I think there's maybe 20 people in here right now.
Half of those working booths.
Yeah, and half of those are working the booths, and the other half of the booths have already gone home. So, but we've had point of reference. We've had probably 8 inches or more of snow since yesterday evening.
I heard 10 to 12 10 this to 12. Morning.
There you go. 10 to 12. I was just guessing. Yeah. And I walked here, so I just need to measure it up my ankle.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How far are your pant legs wet?
I know. So we're going to link to that previous, episode so you can hear that. But I want to first talk about, because we haven't talked to you about this on the podcast yet, but you came out with a second series. So first tell us, what is America from the Ground Up? And then we'll talk about the season two.
Well, America from the Ground Up is a ongoing series for public television that explores American history and archaeology. That's kind of the short version. Within that, it is a extension of my work in public archaeology and public communication of archaeological science. So what we try to do is we try to present research-based archaeology to a television audience and wrap that in a story so that we're telling the audience a story, and embedded within that is real hard art science, as hard as archaeological science ever gets. It's a bit fluffy and squishy, but you know what
right,
I mean.
Right.
And so there are three seasons that we planned. Season one looked at the area of cultural impact or the cultural legacy, if you will, of France and America. Season two, we looked at the cultural legacy of Spain on America. And season three, we're going to go back and we're going to pick up the British model of colonization and talk about the things culturally that we inherit from Britain that flavor who we become as Americans. So, for example, the model of colonization.
Right.
The British model to distill it down to its almost unrecognizable ether, if you will, settlement and land clearance, and that's really the American model. And it colors how we relate with the continent's indigenous peoples from the very beginning of what is now America.
Yeah.
And so that'll be one of the themes that we follow through that whole season. And then another of the themes is going to be, I'm really fascinated by trade and industry in that context. So how, if you look at the founding of America, much of the early colonization, particularly from the British standpoint, is commercial in nature. The early charters are commercial charters. The early colonies foundations, many of them are again, as I said, commercial in nature. So how does that then affect the trajectory of the American story? And how do we look at that archaeologically?
Right.
So, you know, each of these three seasons has a, you know, has sort of a theme that we follow. And that as I'm writing that season now, that's what's emerging.
Nice.
Yeah. And then, you know, geographic footprint for these is pretty broad. For season one, we filmed Quebec, Montreal, the Great Lakes, down the Mississippi to New Orleans. You know, 30 plus archaeological sites in 10 or 11 states. And then season three, summer of 2017, I spent a big chunk of time, about 8 weeks, crammed into a van with a film crew, and we drove 13,000 miles across the American West, visiting 12 states, 35 archaeological and historical sites, museums across the West. We filmed, if you draw a line from Missouri to California, yeah, we filmed in every state but Nevada. We just didn't want to have to see you.
I know. Yeah, I remember. Well, this is great. And I like this show. And I like that you said, you know, a research-based show. Give everybody your background a little bit. You're not a celebrity that's been in like movies and TV shows, right?
No, I'm the most obscure celebrity on planet Earth, if that's the case. Yeah. Nobody's ever heard of me.
I know. So what's your background in archaeology?
My background, I have a PhD in archaeology from University of York in the UK, where I studied, you know, my main area of research interest is early medieval mortuary monumentality, death and burial, 5th to 10th century. But when I was doing my master's degree in history at Central Michigan University, my sort of subfield was Native American history.
Yeah.
And that sort of has stuck with me as an area of interest. And so the America from the Ground Up project kind of grew out of my experience in the classroom and how I look at communicating the American story. I think I said last time, the reason that I got involved in this is was looking around for a documentary on Cahokia. This was in 2010. And the most recent thing that had actually focused on any research at all, other than something idiotic like ancient aliens built this or something, was done by the BBC in 1991. And
Had like the VHS squiggle lines in it.
Right, pretty much, yeah. And so I thought, well, you know, this is ridiculous. Somebody should do something. And I had over several months, I sort of thought about it and started to work out how I might write that documentary. Mm-hmm. And then I had a relationship with a small family foundation who agreed to give me a minuscule budget of about $14,000 to do a project. And there's there's a 22-minute documentary on Cahokia that's still out, sort of floating around on the internet and various places on YouTube and stuff. But it became basically a pilot project for the longer format public television series.
Yeah. I mean, there's got to be a lot packed into that statement, though, the pilot project, because, I mean, you saw a need and you had the ambition to create this Cahokia video. But really, right when that was done, did you think, wow, okay, that's done, I'm going to go back to what I was doing? Or did you kind of get the bug for video production and presenting this way?
Yes, is the answer. I pretty quickly moved from, well, I'm just going to do this, to I really see the potential for public engagement with this. You know, a bit more background about me. I've worked in museums throughout my career. I've been the director of a museum here in the U.S. and worked at senior sort of management roles in other museums in international settings. So, the basics of what I do as a filmmaker now really are rooted in what I did as a public archaeologist and museum professional.
Right.
Natural outgrowth of one was the other.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's great. I mean, I get that question too. Like, how did you get into podcasting? It was like, well, I was looking for podcasts on cultural resource management archaeology.
Right. And there wasn't anything there. Yeah. So I thought, well, how hard could it be?
Yeah. And I did think that, but you know, that process from, wow, there's nothing out there to, I'm actually going to do this was like probably a year and a half for me, you know, cause I didn't have the time. I was a shovel bum, you know, and circumstances had to align to really bring that into focus. And then like you, you know, once I did the first one, I think it was within a couple of years we'd started the Archaeology Podcast Network, and now we have a bunch of things. So along those lines, you're now running your video production company to get these America from the Ground Up videos going. I think what I'm more interested in, though, is how do we get more archaeologists to not only present their work in this way, but to want to engage in the public in this way? Because we tend to be kind of heads down as a field and just like, I want to do my research, which is a problem across all the sciences. I mean, you just want to be in the lab, you want to be in the field, you just want to have a shovel or a trowel in your hand, and you just want to be doing work. You don't want to have to get up in front of a camera and do these things. But how can we change that attitude? Because we end up with people like Megan Fox, who we talked about a couple days ago, who's got this new series on the Travel Channel, and we end up with people being the face for our business and our industry. Right?
Yeah.
She is the new face of archaeology.
Oh, thank you, television.
How do we fix that?
There's a lot to unpack there, boy. Well, first off, let's start with our colleagues. And it really comes down to, are we actually serious about public archaeology, or do we assume that that's just something somebody else is going to do?
Right. I think the second one.
Yeah, and I think that's the issue. So are we requiring public archaeology courses at the undergraduate level? Are we requiring public archaeology components, public engagement components in project designs? Sometimes is the answer. But I think that it requires a fundamental shift in how we approach what we do. Is the public an afterthought that we get to throw our crumbs to?
Right.
Or is there a public service component to what we do? And is that valuable to society as a whole? And I don't mean to be too flippant about it, but I really think that if we will approach public engagement, public archaeology, with the same intentionality, the same methodological seriousness with which we approach a project design and incorporate it into that project design, I think things will start to change. But I really do think it has to start at that level. Public archaeology cannot be an afterthought of what we do.
Right.
It has to be a component and an integral component of what we do.
But in some grants and other funding aspects, you know, having some sort of public archaeology component is sometimes a requirement, like you said. And I know I work out in Nevada, and sometimes on BLM projects, depending on the project and where the kind of how they're funding it, there is a public archaeology component as well. But I tell you what, out in Nevada, 9 times out of 10, it's one of 3 things that gets done for public archaeology. And that's either a website, which, great, if they didn't have one for the site before, that's the first place somebody's probably going to look.
Right.
So the next one is plaques up on the, display boards.
Oh, those are riveting things.
Right. I mean, everybody loves to read those.
Gets me out of bed in the morning.
I know. And then the third thing is sometimes some sort of town hall-like presentation.
At the local library.
At the local library, right. Mm-hmm. Somebody will do something like that. And those are the kinds of things we think of. And I don't want to diminish those efforts, because if they don't exist, they probably should for that area, for that site. But thinking about doing something that's more high profile, you know, to bring it back to TV, you know, Megan Fox, she's a celebrity, and people probably tuned in because they know that name. One of the things I heard, the current hosts of the Women in Archaeology show, they were talking on another podcast, the Archie Fantasies podcast, and, you know, they're all women. So the first thing they recognized, which I, of course, didn't, which I should have, was that she's like the only woman on TV presenting archaeology right now, like even in a bad way.
Right. Like, yes.
Like, so that's a problem fundamentally.
Lots to unpack in that one.
I know. And so it's just like, you know, getting people to either partner with somebody, and this is what we were talking about the other day, and I'm really adamant about this, because I think we have to play the game, really. And if the game the public wants to play is, I want to see a celebrity tell me things and I want to believe them. We all listened to Jenny McCarthy when they said, don't vaccinate. And she's an idiot. And now we're paying the price.
We have, like, you know, polio reemerging because, you know, science doesn't matter.
Right.
But this gets to the point I'm trying to make. And that is that if you let somebody else tell your story, don't complain when they screw it up.
Right. Right.
You know, we have to take control of our story and present it. It really is why I started doing this, because it gets done so badly on television. And it's not just the fault of archaeologists not wanting to engage. There are well-intentioned people out there who are engaging, but who are also a little leery of production companies who may misrepresent.
Yeah.
And I've heard that happening before. So I have, you know, that's one of the challenges I have. I have to fight back against that and go, no, I actually am, you know, not a hack. Maybe I'm a hack archaeologist. That's irrelevant. But, you know, I'm trying to do good research-based stuff here.
At PBS, you've sold out.
yeah, public television, selling out.
PBS checks.
Oh, yeah, exactly. with my mendicant bowl. Please, sir, can I have some more?
Nice.
So, but controlling the narrative, we have a compelling story to tell. We're talking about humanity. We're talking about human beings. It is a compelling story.
Yeah.
So I understand that not everyone is comfortable jumping up in front of a camera. Trust me, I've also interviewed some people you don't want in front of a camera because they're not good at it.
Right.
So I understand, you know, I'm not in any way, shape, or form saying that everybody has to do this, what I'm trying to do. This just happens to be the venue that opened up for me, and that, you know, because of a background in public engagement, because I stand around and talk to people all the time, and I, you know, it translates well on camera. But the willingness to engage with technologies like film, video, the internet, web, mm-hmm. YouTube, all of these things, a willingness to engage with those and to try to draw people in by telling an engaging story isn't something that we should be, or I should say is something that we should be doing. And it isn't something that we should be threatened by.
Right.
Once I tell a story, I can't control what somebody else takes in from that.
Mm-hmm.
If they miss the point, as long as the information I've presented in a film is accurate, I've done my job.
Yeah.
And I try to do it in a compelling, interesting, hopefully entertaining way. But that fear of misrepresentation, I think, is a major impediment on the part of our colleagues to engaging in these kinds of projects.
I would love to say that when we look back on this 10 years from now, 15 years from now, whatever the case is, that you were foundational in doing this. And I'm saying that because, you know, I thought the same thing about podcasting. It took me several years of doing it and screwing it up and learning how to edit audio and learning how to interview. I don't know how many interviews I screwed up and sounded like a total jackass, but I was the editor, so I was able to fix it a little bit. And, you know, doing those things before I started engaging other people and saying, hey, you have a story to tell. Do you want to put a show on the Archaeology Podcast Network?
Yeah.
And being the facilitator for that. So anytime I interview somebody or I meet somebody at a conference and I'm like, man, you have got, this would be a great podcast and I'll help you do that. And all you got to do is bring yourself to the table and I'll cover everything else. Now, admittedly, podcasting is way easier and way cheaper to do that for. Video is different, but
Video is a little more expensive.
It's a little more expensive and you can't
eye-wateringly expensive.
I know. And you can't just, I mean, you got to pay the bills, so you can't just put it on YouTube and call it good and hope you get 10 million views, right? Because that's probably not going
to
happen.
Right. And it comes down to one of the things I wanted to talk about is a budget. You know, how much does this stuff cost? Well, I mean, a good rule of thumb is nothing of any real quality for under $2,000 a minute.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a 1 hour documentary that you're trying to do, you're looking at a minimum budget of $120,000.
$2,000 a minute,
and that's minimum. I mean, anything that's decent is going to come in somewhere around $200.
Right.
I managed to do the 6 episodes of an America from the Ground Up series for a whole lot less than that, but that's because of partnering with Central Michigan University, who has the College of Liberal Arts and Social Sciences there. And the previous dean, Pam Gates, and the new dean have committed to putting resources and time into the project So that brings our budget down by partnering with the university. We don't have to do things like buy insurance.
Nice.
Which can be expensive.
I imagine.
If you want to film in a national park site, you have to have and most archaeologists who do CRM will know you have to have a couple of million dollars worth of liability insurance. Yep. That's not cheap. But by working through the university, we don't have to do that. They can take care of that for us. You know, and so it's, you know, my budget, I'll be completely transparent. I'm trying to raise $250,000 to $280,000 to do the third season.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that represents a solid year of my time.
Right.
And 6 months time of my business partner, Andrew Deviney, who's a historian up at Central Michigan University, and 6 months halftime of my producer director, Dan Bracken. So those are things that, you know, those are costs that we all have to bear. I mean, I have some rent I'd like to pay. I have a wife who doesn't want to live in a cardboard box.
Right.
And so, yeah. You know, it's when you look at the production of film, you know, it's not cheap.
No.
It is an expensive medium. Which leads me to another point. Television commissioners are very reluctant to commission research-based archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
It's a heavy lift to get them to want to put something on television that they don't know on the front end what they're going to get.
Right.
I understand part of that. If I walk up to you and say, I want to sell you a car, but I'm not going to tell you what it looks like. I'm not going to tell you what color it's going to be. And I'm not going to tell you, you know, if it even has four tires. So, you know, it's not, that's slightly facetious, but I understand some of the reluctance. But the other part of the reluctance is certainly the way that it's always been done.
Right.
You know, the other problem is, and I won't go into details and I won't name names, but they want big, splashy, sensational stories that they can sell to the public to draw eyeballs in.
Mm-hmm.
That's, at the end of the day, a commercial network is in the business of attracting viewers. And so it's difficult to sell research-based archaeology that's not uncovering the next latest and greatest splashiest thing that's going to revolutionize the way we think about X.
Yeah.
Well, the quickest way to get yourself in trouble is to oversell a project. And there are producers, one most recently, who walked into a buzzsaw of accidentally not intending to make a piece of white nationalist propaganda, but did because they didn't know the background to what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Producer wasn't an archaeologist. It was commissioned by an international network, shall we say. And it was a major controversy.
Yeah.
And so that is one of the perils that the system that exists sets up for producers. So that's why commercial production companies are often reluctant to get involved in archaeology.
Right.
Because they don't know how to do it. And it's not what they do. And one of the several people I've talked to at conferences over the last year who really do good stuff and are very interested in doing public engagement in science have said to me, it's so difficult to do archaeology because it takes so long and you have to wait so long for results.
Mm-hmm.
And that is certainly true for many projects. But I think one of the advantages that myself and Stratigraphic Productions, my company, has, shameless plug, splcfilms.com.
Nice. Links in the show notes.
Exactly. One of the advantages that we have is that as an archaeologist, I can go to a site, which is what we do regularly for the America from the Ground Up project, talk to archaeologists about, okay, what are you doing? How are you doing it? What are you trying to find here? And I can play translator for the public. And then when I'm editing that together with all of the other sites that we've gone to that work along with that theme in that episode to tell the story, my job is the primary video editor, story editor, I should say. And then it is to put that together in a way that makes sense. And then because Andrew and I are the primary writers, along with Josh Koenig, our colleague at Western Michigan, we write the story around the archaeology. and right into and out of those interviews. But if you're a commercial production company that doesn't have an archaeologist with a, you know, at least in some kind of advanced degree on staff, that's not really something realistically that you're going to do.
Right.
So it adds to the cost of that stuff for them.
Right.
But it, again, our competitive advantage, if you're a company and you want a competitive advantage, which you do, that's what we bring to the table.
And that's, man, I really don't want to undersell that either, because the experience you're building doing this, because you've learned, obviously, video editing along the way and audio production and all this stuff, just mm-hmm. because this is a small operation, so you've had to have your hands in all this. Even if you hire somebody to do it, you've got to understand it. But gaining that understanding, even if you're not the primary one doing some of this stuff, will help you develop that in the future. You know, and when you hire somebody to do this, you'll know what you're getting for your money, because you'll know what it takes to do it.
You'll know with audio editing, there's right. there is a steep learning curve.
Sure.
And, you know, when I started this, I knew nothing about filmmaking. I'd never taken a film class. I'd never taken a creative writing class, I think, beyond the sort of requirements of the undergrad level. So everything is stuff that I have learned, you know, starting in 2010 to today. And I'm constantly learning and finding, you know, trying to find new, you know, online materials that I can use to teach myself.
Yeah.
There are some tremendous tech instructional videos out on, you know, on YouTube, on professional video sites and things. You just, you know, you learn over time. And I would say that I am now a fairly competent video editor. Whereas, you know, 3 years ago I was barely functional, but yeah, it's a process of learning.
Well, it seems like the outright cost of at least the equipment is certainly coming down to produce pretty high quality 4K video.
Well, that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
I don't think 15 to 20 years ago that I could have done this.
Sure. You need a camera rig and the whole thing.
Well, right. Yeah. And the cost was just exponentially higher. 4K video is kind of the standard now, not for broadcast. Most broadcast is in 1080p. Mm-hmm. I know, you know, most people are just like, who cares what, but welcome to tech nerd land.
Yeah,
but
right.
What that means is that 1080p is high definition television. That is what 99% of all broadcast and cable television is presented in.
Mm-hmm.
So 4K has become, though, a standard for video capture in the industry, and I love working with it. Just as an editor, it gives me so many more options in the edit suite. I can reframe a shot. I can cut an entire screen down to one, almost a quarter, and not lose resolution.
Nice.
Which is not something you could do. So it makes my job easier, but it's also much less expensive. The two cameras that we used on season two, the two primary cameras. One was a Panasonic Pro Video 4K camera, fixed lens. The other was a GH4, a Panasonic GH4, which is a 4K DSLR camera.
Yeah. Well, did you also have some drone shots?
We did. We used a Phantom. We used a DJI Phantom 4.
Yes.
The camera on that is just beautiful.
Right.
In terms of the video capture, and I think that comes across on screen in the new season.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, by combining those three really primary cameras, then we shot the entire thing in 4K, gave us huge flexibility in the edit. But also, I think just a note about cost, they're not tremendously expensive.
Right.
You know, the Panasonic Pro Video Cam we were using was somewhere in the region of $5,000, which I know that sounds like a lot, but 20 years ago, you'd have been talking like $40,000.
Right.
And the GH4, you know, you can pick one of those. That's now, you know, it's kind of older technology now, but they're still manufacturing that and the GH5. You can get the camera for, you know, under $1,500. Lenses are an entirely different ballgame. My God, that stuff is expensive.
Yeah.
You know, then on the most recent project we filmed, the Trail of Tears doc that'll be coming out in the spring. It's finished now, but waiting on a few things in terms of like broadcast dates and stuff. But the primary camera on that was a Red cinema camera. And that thing probably cost about $40,000 with lenses. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. But
yeah,
that was a fairly expensive camera. Enough about tech. You'll probably just edit most of that out. You can see people's eyes glazing over and they're like, oh God, no.
Maybe I'll drop it on another show, the Archaeotech podcast.
There you go. Yeah.
Well, I'd love to see, because I think we need enablers for this. And I see myself as an enabler for anybody that wants to do a podcast. I can get them up and running on that. But video is really where we get the big numbers, right? A podcast about archaeology will simply never get the numbers of even a bad TV show about archaeology, right? I mean, it's just, we just don't get the visibility because people want to sit and watch TV. So I'd love to see two things in the future. One, a booth at these conferences where, you know, it's like, I had the idea from a podcast standpoint. I don't know if this would work for video. You have to tell me, but the Archaeology Podcast Network has a booth at the Society for California Archaeology meeting coming up at the end of March. And I'm going to have a little area in there and a sign that says, tell us your archaeological story. But really, this is a covert operation because I want more podcast hosts. But you can't just have somebody that has a great idea, as you know, or a great research topic, get on the microphone consistently.
They have to be able to come across and present rather than... Yeah,
exactly. And you can tell in the first 5 minutes of interviewing somebody if they're going to be good on a microphone, if they're comfortable, if they can interview other people. You know, you can just tell their comfort level. Now, some people can learn that. But if you want to get somebody up and running fast, so my thought is to have somebody in this, you know, I'll have one of my APN hosts sitting there and basically interviewing people and saying, tell me your archaeological story, just 5-10 minute interviews. But really, it's kind of an audition. And we'll contact them later and say, hey, you sounded
great. Pretty good. Have you ever thought about it? That's a good idea,
and
actually.
And that's how I've got most of my shows. And I'd love to see something like that for video because it really is the medium people consume things by. And doing something like that, and I mean, do you think that would be something you guys would be looking forward to in the future? Because I'd really like to see you as like the video production company people go to, because maybe we're not doing this because there's no outlet for it.
I would like to be the video production company that people go to as well.
Right.
SBLLCfilms.com.
I mean, it's run by archaeologists. But you have a PhD in archaeology. You've got the credentials. You're building the portfolio. You know, why go to some random production company that's trying to sell to Discovery when they could go to you?
Right. And the thing is, budgets. Because I don't have the budget to make your documentary because everybody has a great idea, just like for a podcast, everybody has a great idea.
Yes.
But it is expensive. And if you bring an idea, I have to then go sell that to a network and they may not always bite.
For sure.
So, you know, but you're right in terms of numbers. Let's see. Season one of America from the Ground Up has aired. It's still airing. It's in sort of repeats, if you will. But it's aired on more than 300 public television stations across the United States. It's aired multiple times in the UK to a national audience there. If you think about the six episodes, just with, let's say, 300, six episodes in the United States, that's 1,800 episodes that have played across the United States presenting research-based archaeology in the context of American history.
Right.
And, you know, for season two, which came out in August of this year, has already been on about 100 and I would say about 140 public television stations nationwide. The newer thing that we're doing now is that the most recent is that we have put both seasons on the PBS website, pbs.org/show/America-ground, and you should find it.
We'll put the link in the show notes.
Yeah, and that has certainly been a different way to get the product out there. One of the benefits of that is we put it outside the sort of, not paywall, but the member privilege within the PBS video portal. It's available freely to anyone who wants to access it because I want to see people use it in the classroom.
Sure.
At the university level and at the school level. Yeah. I think it works for both. Just yesterday, got an email. It will be popping up on Hulu in some form, shortly.
Nice.
I can't tell you what that is because I didn't really understand what that email was about. I just had to say yes.
That's how we'll watch it. My wife and I were total cable cord cutters. Everything is Netflix, Hulu, Amazon Prime.
And see, more people are. And so we've been exploring options to get another part of the component of that is Sling. Sling Lite or whatever? It'll be available in some form on that, probably through local stations. Because a lot of PBS local stations, what they're doing is they're partnering with Sling or Hulu for their local markets. And so our content will then, you know, if that, let's say the Los Angeles station, San Bernardino, I think, is the one for that. They've shown America from the Ground Up. If they have a agreement with Hulu Light or Sling Light or whatever that is, to air their or to show their content, we would then be part of that. I think that's how it works, but I didn't read the fine print. I just said yes. And
speaking of fine print, that brings up a question. Now that this is on PBS, and correct me if I get the terminology wrong, but you basically sold this to PBS. Is that right?
No.
No. Oh, so
it's
can you play
on
it in other
public
places?
Television? It can. We have a. This is when you start getting into how do networks work.
Right. Right.
So there are three main content providers for PBS.
Okay.
PBS Corporation for Public Broadcasting, American Public Television, and NEDA, the National Educational Telecommunications Association. NEDA is our syndicator.
Okay.
So we are an independent producer. Stratigraphic Productions, is an independent producer. We sign a distribution agreement with NEDA through our partner at WCMU Public Media up at Central Michigan University, who are the copyright holders, because that's one of the reasons we partner with them, is because the goal is to make this thing freely available to as many people as possible. Right. WCMU and CMU get that, they want to do that. So through that partnership with WCMU Public Media, NEDA is our provider. They feed it out to all of their member stations. I think a few public television stations across the country are not PBS affiliates. Mm-hmm. So it goes beyond sort of outside of that system as well. So it's made available to those 370 public television stations in their system. So that once you start getting into the nuts and bolts of how these programs get on air, you know, who distributes what, it's just like if you watch the Ellen DeGeneres show, it's on NBC stations, because their syndicator kind of taps into the networks of stations, but they are not produced by a network. They're produced as they're an independent production that then gets syndicated. Gotcha. So I think I have satisfied the lawyers who will not send me nasty letters and sue me for saying it's a PBS show.
Right. I think that's something people don't understand. I'm gaining a little more understanding on that, because I've been, as a podcaster, I'm searchable on Google. So I've been contacted by production companies that say, hey, we're working on a show for X channel.
Right.
That we want to
sell. And we're looking for Bigfoot. You want to help?
Exactly. That's pretty much it. Yeah. So I think.
Do you want to lend us some legitimacy and wreck your credibility? Sure. Yeah, exactly. Sign me up.
I know. Speaking of that, that was a big question I want to ask, because of course we mentioned, Megan Fox, but there's other people out
nothing
there.
But nothing but credibility happening there.
Because I think two things. One, I think that within archaeology, we do have a Bill Nye the Science Guy. We do have a Neil deGrasse Tyson. We have somebody who is well qualified in that field and can present this. And this might be you as we go forward. We might look back and say, this is the genesis of your Neil deGrasse Tysonhood.
Don't do that to me. I'm trying to get out from in front of the camera and stay behind it. A quick blurb about that. That's really hard work to turn up, do the dancing monkey routine on camera, help direct and produce the thing, do the pre-interviews with the folks that we're talking with. So it's a much more leisurely work pace if I can just stay out from in front of the camera, but I'm not opposed to that.
Well, and along those lines, have you thought about approaching somebody who might have some more celebrity, somebody that is well known to the public, that could be like a really be the person the camera kind of focuses on and takes focus away from you, but then when you have to say something intelligent, it comes back to you, and they're like they're the person that's interested, not necessarily a Megan Fox style person, because she really was bringing a lot of pseudoscience into it, but somebody who's interested, has the name credibility, and can really just bring viewers because it's X person, you know?
That would be project based. There's a project I'm trying to develop, and I'll be vague because hasn't gone anywhere.
Yeah.
But it involves looking at the materiality of writing and thinking about the material culture of writing. And so that would lend itself to, and I've probably already said too much, so please just delete that part. Yeah, because somebody else.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to get ripped off. Yeah. But it's a project, you know, it would be project-based and situational. And so if there's a person who has an interest in and the ability to interact, but I don't know. I mean, sometimes celebrity is a tricky thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean, I've thought about those things because those are the kinds of things that many commercial networks are looking for. Tie-ins to, you know, there's this thing that was done with Will Smith where he's jumping up and down in front of a green screen most recently. I don't even remember what it was about. It was some sort of science project. I watched part of an episode and just thought, huh. And, you know, it wasn't my thing. I met the person who produced it and, you know, they had good intentions and they were trying hard.
Right.
And from what I remember, it was reasonably good science. Okay, mm-hmm. Fair enough. I'm not going to complain about reasonably good science on TV. I don't know. That's a tough one because, you know, the person would have to be interested in what you're doing.
Right.
Enough to spend some time on it. But you've also got to think about budgets, too.
Yeah.
You know.
But look
the
at
bigger
the
your celebrity,
well.
The bigger your cost.
Sure, but I think looking at the, you know, for me, it's really difficult for archaeologists, really any science profession, to look at the bigger picture because, like you said, the Will Smith thing didn't really, you know, wasn't really something you were totally interested in. He was being a goofball, doing whatever. But a lot of people probably watched that and maybe learned a little something. And maybe producing television and producing documentaries that aren't necessarily for our colleagues, because most of our colleagues are here at these conferences or working on the next research paper and not even maybe even watching that much TV.
Trust me, I have no aversion to popular history projects. If they're well done,
sure.
Look, if you entertain somebody and you pique their interest and they go and even if they hit up the Google machine and do some basic look, you know, reading on something, they'll have learned something.
Yeah.
So I, you know, there are a couple of projects that I'm trying to develop that are popular history based projects that I think would be really interesting. They're not meant for a scientific convention. They're not meant to be anything other than an entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
But there's no reason that entertainment can't be interesting and informative.
Right.
So no, I certainly am not averse to those kind of projects. I like I said, there are a couple of them I would like to do,
mm-hmm.
But you know, it does come down to, you know, the kind of project you are trying to put out,
mm-hmm.
And that's where, you know, the other thing I want to say is there are numbers of very good commercial production companies who are trying diligently to do good science stuff, some more than others. But there's the World Congress of Science and Factual Producers, mm-hmm. that the vast majority of the folks there are tapped into, you know, the Smithsonian channels. Their stuff is going out on National Geographic and Discovery. And all of those have varying degrees of factually accurate, more or less successful programs. Some of them have Bigfoot.
True story.
I can't do anything about that. That's the lake you swim in.
That's right.
But I was up in my business partner Andrew Davini and I were up in Boston at WGBH back in September for the Science Media Summit.
Nice.
And that was hosted by WGBH and that was by WGBH and the Jackson Hole Wildlife Media. Awards and Film Fest. And that was a really great experience because it was a chance to get together and talk to people from around the world who are doing this kind of stuff. So there are, you know, there are outlets out there. I will be honest with you. The vast majority of them are public television mm-hmm. stations or broadcasters internationally.
Right.
Whether it's the BBC and PBS at the sort of gold standard and ZDF in Germany. You know, in France and internationally, the public broadcasters, because they have a remit to engage the public with quality educational science, culturally beneficial projects, right. if you will, however right. you want to describe that remit, that tends to be the majority. But again, you know, National Geographic Channel does a decent job most of the time, you know, some of the others as well. It just... Mm-hmm. You know, We'll see. I mean, History Channel, places like that, we'll see how they evolve.
Yeah. Well, I think, as I mentioned, getting some kind of celebrity on there, that would be definitely short-term gains, and it may never, like Megan Fox's show, may never see the light of day after in the next month or so because the ratings I've heard were so bad. But that being said...
Well, that's okay. The writing was so bad.
I know. She wrote it, too. But that being said, you look at some of the people that I did mention. I didn't mention Carl Sagan. You know, Carl Sagan was... I mean, just about everybody knows the name.
Immensely influential on me as a kid. I was obsessed with that show.
But how many people do you think probably watched Cosmos when it first came out? What was that, early 80s, late 70s?
Yeah, I'm old.
Yeah, well, yeah, I watched it too. At least my dad did, and I was there. Yeah, but anyway.
Same here. I mean, I'm not that old, but I'm old.
Right. Yeah, but how, you know, that almost gained like a weird cult following. And
yeah.
It just stayed in the news.
Absolutely.
And then Neil deGrasse Tyson redid mm-hmm. it a few years ago.
Yeah.
And to great production value as well.
Yeah.
So it can be done with people in the field, in the industry that are experts, and they can become their own celebrities.
There's room in the market for that. And that's what I'm arguing, is that there is room in the market for smart, entertaining television. Yeah. Expect something from your audience and they'll come up to it. Respect them. This is one, I will say that there are some of these reality type shows, not even reality, they're just sort of manufactured nonsense. And I'll throw this out there because the guy said it in public. The Storage War thing.
Oh, yeah.
This is just one of the dumbest concepts. That guy made a fortune. Great. Make your fortune. God bless you, pal.
Right.
He's never going to hear this because he probably didn't care. So he's mm-hmm. never going to come punch me in the nose. Fine. But said something at a television conference where, you know, he's about respect for the audience. And he says, well, if you think that they're going to find Napoleon's sword in a storage shed in Simi Valley, you're an idiot and you deserve it. Yeah. Okay, well, that's what you think about your audience.
Yeah.
I choose to think that, you know what, I'm going to respect my audience. And I'm going to try and ask you to come along on a journey with me. Mm-hmm. And hopefully I entertain you. And hopefully you learn something.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, I think there's room in the market for that.
Yeah, I think so too. All right. Well, I think, we're looking at the foundation of the Monty Dobson empire here. So,
exactly. Yes. Soon to be appearing on lunchboxes everywhere.
That's right. But I think taking the lessons from people like Carl Sagan, Neil deGrasse Tyson, Bill Nye the Science Guy. I don't know why these physicists and, Bill Nye was actually an engineer, I think. But anyway, I don't know why those types of scientists seems to be more, television sexy, but maybe it's because of the graphics they can put, and we don't know much about what's going on out in space, so they can make any graphic they want. But they did the hard work. They did the lectures. They did the public lectures and getting themselves out there in a phrase. And I think if we just need archaeologists to stand up and speak in front of people and...
Yeah, this is the thing. Jump in. People want to hear the stories we have to tell.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I've learned from this project and the feedback that I've gotten. People appreciate being talked with,
sure.
not at, but talked with in a way that respects them and tells them your story and mm-hmm. bring them along on that journey. And I think I jump in.
Yeah.
The more that we can do this, the more support we're going to build and the more we're going to build an audience.
All right. Well, we'll have links to all your resources that have been mentioned in the show notes over at the Archaeology Podcast Network, archpodnet.com. And Monty, thanks for coming on the show.
Chris, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song, I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning. Keep discovering new things and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle.
in Reno, Nevada at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.